good morning, and welcome to the KUNM Collin Show. My name is Kathleen Sabo. The 2013 wildfire season is in early full swing in New Mexico. Drought is extreme across much of the state, and two fires sparked by downed power lines have been growing in size in the Santa Fe National Forest. Today we'll be getting an update on the Tres Lagunas and Thompson Ridge fires. We'll look at how the extreme drought is impacting fire conditions, and we'll find out what utility companies are doing to prevent power lines from starting more fires. Joining me to explore these issues are veteran reporter John Fleck of the Albuquerque Journal, who is in the studio with me, along with PNM Metro and East Mountain Operations Manager Steve Detmer. Welcome to both of you here.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Also joining me on the phone is Dan Ware. He is the Fire Prevention and Outreach Program Manager with the New Mexico State Forestry. Thank you for joining us by phone, Dan. All right, Dan, I know you're there. Later on, we'll be joined by Keith Nix. He is also a PNM employee. If you would like to join in our discussion today, there are several ways for you to participate. You may email comments to callinshow@kunm.org. You may post comments on the Collin Show webpage at kunm.org. Or you may call our local number, 277-5866. That's 277-KUNM. Or you can dial us toll-free, 1-877-899-5866 with questions and comments, and we'll appreciate your participation. So, Dan, are you with us on the phone?
I am.
Hey, good morning, Dan. And
good
Dan,
morning.
Yes, and I know you are busy these days. You've been participating in frequent public updates of the size and location of these two fires, Tres Lagunas and Thompson Ridge, including a briefing with the governor yesterday afternoon. And I'm going to let you choose, just giving us our own update about any changes in the scope of or behavior of either fire. I do note that the Albuquerque Journal had a front page story on Thompson Ridge, but I looked at the update this morning. It appears that there were some good news with that fire, but go ahead, start with either one.
Well, sure. And, you know, we had a very interesting day yesterday. It started off very dry and pretty breezy, and then we had some storms develop, and we got a lot of rain on the Tres Lagunas fire, which yesterday, we reported about 9,441 acres. This morning, it's at 9,558, and I was looking at our maps, our overnight maps, and there really wasn't a whole lot of growth. And so that's really good news as far as the Tres Lagunas fire goes. It's not over yet by any stretch of the imagination. We do expect a little bit more moisture there today, but this weekend looks to be very dry, so we're in for the long haul. The Thompson Ridge fire is now actually the bigger of the two fires. This morning, the maps indicate that it's just over 12,000 acres, and so they've had some pretty substantial runs in the last couple of days, it looks like. A lot of dense vegetation out there and a lot of very steep, rugged terrain that makes it difficult to get a toehold, to put a line around it in some places. So, and also they did do some burnout operations, and so that adds to that total acreage. But sometimes when you've got that just really inaccessible terrain, a burnout is the easiest way to remove the fuel from the path of the fire.
Now, you said Thompson Ridge is about 12,000 acres. How much did it grow overnight?
Well, last night's report that was sent from the fire listed it at 10,400 acres. And what they do overnight is they fly over it with an infrared camera, and it takes a look at the heat signature. And based on the heat signatures, they can then draw a more accurate map on the fire. So I'm not saying that it grew 2,000 acres overnight. We just have a more accurate fix on the actual acreage. So our infrared maps this morning have it at 12,164 acres. So, you know, I would say that was growth from yesterday, not overnight.
Okay. And Dan, I'll admit to my own ignorance. When I spoke with you yesterday in preparation, I said, well, are any of these fires on state forest land? And you had a little chuckle. So, you know, just explain for us and for the listeners, what kind of land we're talking about here. Whose jurisdiction are these fires found on?
Both of these fires fires are in mixed jurisdiction. There is some private land involved, which falls under state forestry's jurisdiction. There is some national forest land involved, which, of course, is the U.S. Forest Service land. And then with the case of the Thompson Ridge fire, you have the Valles Caldera property, which is a national preserve. So multiple jurisdictions, which, you know, luckily we have very good working relationships with all of our local, state, and federal partners here as far as responding to incidents like this. So we all get involved, and we have to work hard sometimes to all be on the same page, but that's part of the process.
It sounds like it's working in this instance. John Fleck, anybody who's been in Albuquerque a while has seen your name in the Albuquerque Journal. We know you write science-related articles. You also write a science blog that can be found on the Journal website. And in one of your posts yesterday, you mentioned the Southwest Jemez Mountains Landscape Restoration Project, a program to try to clear out forests to reduce fire risks. Did the Thompson Ridge fire originate in that part of the forest that has been or is being cleared as part of the restoration project?
Yeah, the area that this fire is burning in is the area that those folks have been working very hard, both with this formal project, Southwest Jemez Landscape Restoration Project, and also in years past before that through the Valles Caldera and the Santa Fe National Forest to try to get ahead of this problem. And so especially along a portion of the border of the fire, you have an area kind of along the southern edge of the fire where a lot of landscape restoration work had been done, forest thinning, some controlled burning. It's an area that my Journal colleague Dean Hansen and I were in 2 years ago looking at and writing about as an example of how to protect a forest from this kind of fire. And in fact, that area that had been cleared out in the past was used by the fire teams as kind of the southern anchor of fighting the fire, and seems to have worked well. And my colleague Dean Hansen at the Journal was up there yesterday, and what he was saying based on his coverage of the fire is that the area where the fire slowed down and went to ground and didn't get up in the crown and burn intensely, but instead burned in kind of a light intensity way, slowly and gradually and kind of in a safe and healthy fire way, is some of the area that has been thinned. So we've seen some success. I mean, and then the problem here is, as you see by the areas that are burning intensely that haven't been cleared yet, especially on that Redondo Peak area, and the stuff that we saw burn 2 years ago in Las Conchas with incredible intensity over on the east side, the scale of the problem is really enormous. So, you know, there's folks trying to get ahead of it with the Southwest Jemez Project and related work. It's just a very, very big problem, the amount of acreage that is in bad shape up there. And that needs to either be thinned or will eventually burn is just enormous.
Well, and you know, I've been looking at another blog post. I saw you brought up a quotation from someone from 2002 who said, "Hey, even the Valles Caldera could burn given these conditions."
Right.
So that is in fact happening. Dan, anything you want to mention about that clearing that's taken place and the difference in how the fire is being fought in those areas where the clearing happened versus where it hasn't happened yet?
Well, you know, John is absolutely right. In these areas where we've seen some treatments done on the federal land, the public lands, as well as the private lands, the whole goal is to bring that fire down onto the ground, which makes it easier to stop. And we've been working with the local communities up there as well through our FireWise program and our Ready, Set, Go program in teaching folks how to manage their property in a way that if a fire approaches, the goal is to drop it onto the ground and reach an area where there's limited vegetation, which will snuff it out. And so the work that's been done up there, again, it is, as John said, a very long process. We're talking hundreds of thousands of acres, if not millions, overall, when you talk about the state in general, that need to be treated in a way that when a fire is introduced, it will be of a lower intensity and do far less damage.
Okay, Steve Detmer, let's bring you into the conversation here. It's common knowledge that these two fires that we're speaking of, Thompson Ridge and Tres Lagunas, have been started by downed power lines. We want to emphasize that they are not PNM's power lines. They belong to electrical co-ops. We also don't want to cast aspersions on them at this point. No one knows exactly what happened. But, you know, we've got lots of forest land here in the state, and then maybe you know exactly how much we have just because you've been studying this, but how many miles of power lines do we have traversing our forested land here in New Mexico?
I don't think I've got an exact figure on that, but I know we've got thousands of miles of lines. We've got the East Mountains, all of that area. We've got both transmission, which is the high voltage power lines, and the distribution lines as well. And we also serve even the southern part of the state, the Rio Doce area. We've got a lot of lines in that area. You know, as you're aware, we had the Little Bear fire down there last summer. And so we've got thousands of miles of lines. I don't have an exact figure on that.
Well, you know, I do have some figures, and we do want to say we did attempt to get someone from an electrical co-op here today, short notice. They're actually obviously very busy at this point, too. But just for a little bit of scope, so the Hemez Mountains Co-op, and I got this from actually a journal article, serves 33,661 customers in five counties, eight Indian pueblos, parts of the Navajo and Hickory Apache Nation. So right there we see that sort of patchwork of jurisdiction. And they have greater than 4,000 miles of distribution line. So is PNM's, do you think it's more or less than that 4,000?
Quite a bit more. PNM basically has about 500,000 customers. Of course, you know, ours is more concentrated in the metro area. You know, we're not like the co-op where they serve a wider spread area, but we have a roughly 500,000 customers.
Okay, and it was interesting when I looked at the lines that the co-ops are talking about. They only talked about distribution lines. Do they also have transmission lines? And can you tell us the difference between those two kinds of lines?
I'm not sure what their makeup is, but basically the transmission lines is the high voltage, typically 115,000 volts and up is the lines you see crossing the country on the big, it kind of looks like a H-frame structure. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Those are the transmission lines. And PNM has those throughout the state. I mean, we have a power plant in San Juan, and we have those, you know, basically crisscrossing the state. And then the distribution lines is typically like the 12,500-volt power lines you see, you know, in the neighborhoods around town.
Now, I also read that the Tres Lagunas fire started a power line, a private power line, running from a distribution pole to a home on New Mexico 63 was knocked down by strong winds last Thursday afternoon. So we're talking about a private power line running to a home. Is there any way for PNM or an electrical co-op to have knowledge that that happens at the moment that it happens?
Well, PNM has a operations center here in Metro where we can actually actively monitor our lines and we can see changes in load. Typically, you know, load would change if a power line hits the ground or something like that. If it's a customer line from a pole to their house, we're probably not going to see something that minor. But I mean, there's always proactive things we can do. I mean, we have a tree trimming program where we actively trim trees away from our power lines, and that's something that homeowners can do as well. If you see a power line, if you see a tree growing into the power line around your house, they can call PNM or the co-op, I'm assuming, as well, and get those trees trimmed back out of the power line and kind of proactively keep that kind of thing from happening.
But you have people monitoring loads, so when you see an anomaly, you would send someone out to check it, but that's the way it would happen?
That is the way it happens. I mean, we have guys in the field 24/7, and we have people monitoring that at our service center 24/7. So if they see something like that, they would call on the radio and get somebody out there immediately.
We're talking this morning about New Mexico's early wildfire season. In the studio are John Fleck of the Albuquerque Journal and Steve Detmer from PNM. We also have Dan Ware, Fire Prevention and Outreach Program Manager with New Mexico State Forestry. He's on the line by phone. We'll be joined by Keith Nix. We also invite you to join us if you would like to participate. You can email comments to callinshow@kunm.org. You may post comments on the Call and Show webpage at kunm.org. You may call our local number 277-5866. That's 277-KUNM, or our toll-free number 1-877-899-5866 with questions and comments. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we will also be joined by PNM employee Keith Nix.
This summer, be inspired and delighted by the next generation of classical musicians at Taos School of Music as they perform history's greatest compositions at Taos Community Auditorium. Guest artists include the Shanghai String Quartet, Brentano String Quartet, Borromeo String Quartet, Michael Tree, Robert McDonald, and Thomas Sauer. For tickets and details, visit taosschoolofmusic.com or call 575-776-2388. A message from the tax-exempt Taos School of Music.
I'm Steven Spitz, the host of New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. When you hear the latest school shooting, serial killing, or sex offender, do you wonder what was going on in their mind? This Friday morning at 8 a.m., my guest is UNM professor Kent Keel, who has spent his professional career studying the criminal mind and has developed brain scans to predict who among them will reoffend. So please join us this Friday morning at 8 a.m. for a fascinating discussion on KUNM.
Welcome back to the KUNM Call-In Show. As we discuss New Mexico's early wildfire season, I'm joined by Albuquerque Journal reporter John Fleck, New Mexico State Forestry Service Manager Dan Ware, Operations Manager for PNM Steve Detmer, and now, hopefully, I'm joined by Keith Nix, PNM's Director of Technical Services and System Reliability by phone. Good morning, Keith.
Good morning.
Yes, thank you for being on the line. And we've been talking, we've had Steve here in the studio, and we've been talking a bit about how you discover a line has been downed. But one thing I know we wanted to talk to you about, and I understand you're with us for just a short time, is the vegetation surrounding power lines and easements and care for that. And so I'm hoping you can tell us actually, who sets the size of easements and what the size is, whether there's a difference in size between transmission and distribution lines. So Keith, please fill us in on that.
Sure. That's a great question. And I'll apologize in advance if I happen to drop off. I'm actually on a family vacation in the middle of Tropical Storm Andrea. So, you know, it's been a little exciting weather phenomenon for us out here.
Different.
For sure.
Different. Thank you, Keith.
Yeah, sure. Just to kind of elaborate is that the right-of-way width is going to vary, which it's dependent upon what type of land classification it is, as well as the voltage classification of the power line. For example, transmission lines, like Stevens mentioned earlier, that are typically operated at 115,000 volts and above, they have a little bit wider of a right-of-way because, you know, a couple of different factors is, number one, they do span a little bit wider than your average distribution line. And number two, the clearance requirements because of flashover to a nearby tree is a little bit different. So to really answer your question, they can vary anywhere between, you know, 50 feet from the center of the transmission line onto either side of the right-of-way all the way to as little as, you know, 50 feet complete that comprises the whole entire right-of-way. And it depends upon jurisdiction as well, is that depending upon the ownership class of the land, it can vary as well, whether it's private, whether it's public, whether it's Forest Service, state land, et cetera.
Well, who sets those standards? I know the PRC has been, or certainly one commissioner in particular, has been quoted as saying, hey, we've got to do something about making sure that we have enough easement space. And is that the PRC's? They're tasked with regulating utility companies. Is that the PRC's task to set the standard for size for easements, or is that someone else's jurisdiction?
It's usually someone else, and it can be a combination. Like I had said before, it can either be a state entity, it can be a federal entity. Sometimes you actually enter into negotiations with private landowners on how much easement you can be provided. So it'll vary from depending upon land ownership.
Now, I read somewhere that the Hemez Mountain Co-op spent $400,000clearing vegetation last year. Do you have a figure for PNM, what that might cost you?
Right, not an exact figure, but our budgets can number in the millions of dollars. So, you know, it'll range depending upon the types of tree contacts that we're having and the type of year that we're having. So, but typically it's you know, in the millions of dollars.
Okay, let's throw this out to either you or Steve. Now, is there a standard of care or repair required for lines, regardless of who maintains them? And again, who sets that standard?
Right, and I'll answer from a transmission perspective. Recently, I don't know if you're familiar with the North American Electric Reliability Council, or NERC. It's a federal entity that's associated with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and recently they've passed reliability standards for transmission lines that operate at 200,000 volts and above. And what it amounts to is that each utility has to maintain and document a maintenance plan for how it's going to maintain vegetation on its transmission system. So we do have some oversight from the federal government regarding transmission maintenance on right-of-ways for vegetation. So what we do there is that we actually produce a document. We review it every year. It's a requirement that we review it every year for how we calculate different methods of how we're going to trim trees. And that all varies, you know, really upon the type of terrain that you're crossing. Like Steve had mentioned earlier, our transmission crosses pretty much the entire state. So there's definitely cases where the transmission line is over desert where there's definitely no probability of a tree contact occurring, all the way to some, you know, lighter vegetation, sort of the juniper type, the scrub oak kind, that doesn't necessarily have trees tall enough to get into the lines, all the way up to ponderosa pines.
Okay.
But we've got varying standards for tree trimming requirements.
All right. Thank you for clarifying that, Keith. We've got a couple of callers on the line. Let's bring in Dionisio from Villanueva. And Dionisio, I understand you want to talk a little bit about the detection of sparks being monitored. So, Dionisio, thank you for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you very much. I'm listening to NPR and cities around the country, few of them, or the world, that are able to monitor, you know, dumpsters that are overloaded or parking spaces that are available on a particular block in a city. It seems that the power lines that are down should be apt, and it should be almost instantaneous when something like that occurs. And I think it would save a great deal of time. It would be very costly. I don't know if it would be very costly, but it seems to me that there would be some cost, but it would be minimal compared to, you know, all the money that goes into fighting a fire.
Well, are you talking about some kind of camera out there to monitor what's happening?
No, I'm just talking about an app that would somehow, you know, if you can monitor parking spaces, I don't know if it's a camera or whatever, but something with a tree that falls on a power line, there should be some way to app, you know, when a tree has fallen on a power line.
All right. Well, let's Steve respond to that. Thank you so much, Dionisio, for your call.
That's probably not a bad idea. Right now, we're kind of at the mercy of customers, and if somebody sees a down power line, obviously, you know, we count on them to make a call in, and we, as I stated earlier, manage those or monitor those from our local operations center. So, you know, that's not a bad idea. I'm just not sure how that would work.
Well, let's go ahead and bring in our next caller, Miriam from the Jemez Mountains, because Miriam, you sort of have a different take on this. You're out there as a customer of an electric co-op. What would you like to comment?
Well, I am a member of the Jemez Electric Co-op, and I've had some personal experience on my own land with seeing trees on power lines that are igniting, and I think we can't totally depend on the co-op. I mean, some of us here think it's really important to thin our own land and keep an eye on it, not just call the co-op, but my husband came home from work and cut the tree down because it was igniting. The co-op does a terrific job, but they can't be everywhere. So personal stewardship is a very important part of all of this.
Well, and Miriam, while you're on the line, how close are you to the fire right now, and are you experiencing any effects?
I can see the plume from my back deck. Today it's not as bad as it was yesterday. The only personal experience I have is smoke. There's quite a bit of smoke all through the Jemez, but I understand it's further north. Around Los Alamos and White Rock, it's really bad smoke.
All right. Well, thank you for that update, and good luck to you. And Dan, where are you? Still on the line with us?
Yes, I am.
We'll have a link up on our website, but just I looked through the website for the forestry, which actually is part of the Energy, Minerals, and Natural Resources Department, and there is advice for homeowners in there, is there not?
We have a lot of great information there on fire prevention and preparedness.
We have several different programs tailored to individual landowners, to communities, to groups, and a lot of it is, as the caller stated, personal responsibility and stewardship of the land. Whether you've got half an acre or you've got 1,000 acres, taking care of your forest and how you take care of your forest has a direct effect on the total ecology. Forest and watershed health go hand in hand, and if you're out there properly taking care of your land, you're not only creating a better healthy forest, you are also, by just design, creating defensible space, and you're making your land better able to handle a fire when it approaches it.
And John, I know you've written extensively on this, and we want to get back to that. And Steve, you actually have personal experience from the Little Bear Fire, but right now we have Public Regulation Commissioner Valerie Espinoza on the line. So let's go ahead and bring her in. Commissioner Espinoza, thanks so much for calling in. I saw that you were quoted recently in an Albuquerque Journal article as wanting to do more as a member of the PRC. Thank you for joining us today, and we'd love to have you add to this conversation.
Thank you so much.
What do you feel the PRC can do in response to this situation?
Well, as I spent my day up there in the Pecos Wilderness on Friday, witnessing everything that was going on, including, you know, the cost involved to put out the fires and the danger and the land, you know, everything is just, you know, I think there's a place and a time, and this is a very good opportunity to involve all shareholders, stakeholders, everybody that is, including the residents who are crying out right now, to put a plan together. Yesterday we had our public meeting for the Public Regulation Commission, and there we discussed that it's time to step up to the plate and do what we have to do as a commission who regulates the not only the co-op, but the utility services and quality of service. So I'd like to make sure that they have an updated vegetation management plan. And, you know, I'd like to sponsor perhaps a resolution to get the utilities to reinforce their efforts to inspect the lines. And just as a joint effort, and the biggest thing, I think, is personal responsibility. Sometimes you don't want to hear that, but I think that's huge here, especially from the private landowners and what they can do to clear their area if they need help. There are resources available. I know the common cry at the high school was, you know, my parents are elderly. They don't have the resources to cut down these line or these trees that are around our property. So I think once we start a dialogue, we can all put our forces together, including the U.S. Forestry, and I've spoken to the fire marshal to engage him in the process as well. So if we have people at the table, and I don't think we need to learn any more hard lessons, I think we need to take action now and work together and put a plan so that we can prevent this from happening in the future.
You know, and Commissioner Espinoza, there are a couple of things that people talk about. Why can't we make our easements larger? And I saw the spokeswoman for the Hemis Mountains Co-op said, you know, that we have to apply for a variance. And this is, as you might imagine, with the federal government, it's a extensive, sort of complicated procedure. And then other people say, well, let's just bury all the lines. And yet I read it costs $100,000 a mile to bury the lines. So are you looking at personal responsibility as the biggest shift, or is there some other shift?
I think it's one of the above, personal responsibility on private land. But Hemis Co-op is in the middle of a lawsuit because of this right now. But Kit Carson is the actual co-op that spent the $400,000 that you mentioned earlier on clearing. But I think, you know, there's rules, regs that apply that are outside of the PRC that they have to abide by. The U.S. Forestry is one. Plus, you have the Environmental Agency Department who will have to step in, too, and say, well, you know, they have their – everybody has input in this, and that's why it's difficult sometimes for the smaller co-ops to proceed with what they can do. But if you drive up towards the fire on either end, you can see where the lines are actually connecting and growing into some of these overhead power lines. So burying them isn't necessarily an answer. Burying them also costs money and infrastructure, and then that's not to say that there won't be problems with you know, corrosion or underground, you know, problems. So, again, it's an expense, but the personal responsibility certainly on personal property, and that's what we're hearing occurred in the last three fires. I don't have the facts yet, but what I'd like to see is once the investigation's done, I've asked for the co-op Nora Electric to submit all the information to us as a PRC, and then we'll go from there to inquire and see what we can do to contribute and see if they can explain the reasons why these electric utility lines and forests can come into contact with vegetation and how far these lines exist amongst the, you know, the transmission through our state. This is not the only area that it's impacted.
Well, Commissioner, yes.
Again, I just wanted to say that I wanted to spearhead an effort to involve the PRC, and Commissioner Lyons and myself have been appointed to task this task force to bring parties together and, like I said, shareholders to look into future a future plan, a vegetation plan, and just some a joint effort amongst local governments, fire, and all departments involved, and that's what I'm putting together now.
Well, Commissioner Espinoza, thanks for your efforts, and thanks for reaching out to us. As you might imagine, our phone lines are full. I do want to let people know that if you are unable to get through on the line, you may email comments to callinshow@kunm.org. You may post comments on the Call In Show webpage at kunm.org. We'll do our best to get to everything. Thank you so much, Commissioner. Steve, you need to leave in a few minutes. We want to just dig up a personal experience that you had with the Little Bear fire when you were in Ruidoso or outside of Ruidoso.
Right, sure. Prior to moving here, I lived in Ruidoso, so I experienced a Little Bear fire firsthand. It actually burned through the area where I live. And to talk, you know, a little bit more to Dan's comments and some of the previous callers, I had actually done thinning on my property. I owned 6 acres. I proactively thinned that. I was involved in a cost-sharing program that paid for a lot of that. So I was, you know, I actually experienced standing on my deck, watching the blaze come down the hill towards my house. The sheriff knocked on my door at 2 o'clock in the morning and said, "You got to go, you know, leave." I left not knowing what I was going to come back to. Was finally not able to come back about 2 days later. And my property, and I live in a log house, so that's pretty phenomenal. My house was still standing. A couple of my buildings were scorched, but the fire had burned through on the ground, like we talked about. Several of my neighbors lost everything they had. Their houses were burned to the ground, but mine was still standing, and I attribute a lot of that to proactive thinning that I had done on my own.
Did you also have fire-resistant tiles on your roof?
I had a metal roof, which I'm sure helped, but like I said, I live in a log house. So for that to, you know, to basically survive through the wildfire, because the heart of the fire burned right through the middle of my property. When I actually stopped and talked to the police prior to being allowed access back to my house, he showed me on the map where the fire burned through, and he drew a line, you know, right across my house. So I didn't know what I was going to return home to. So it was, you know, it was, I know, you know, what those people are dealing with and that feeling. So, you know, that bleeds over into my work, you know, in the fact that we want to proactively do everything we can to prevent, you know, our power lines causing fires.
And we've heard callers talk about that. We've heard the commissioner talk about it. Dan, you have a lot of information on the state forestry website, and you know, including information about how to build a house, how to fireproof a house. People can certainly go there, can they not?
Absolutely. Our website is nmforestry.com, and you can click on the fire program link, and it will take you to, again, all of the information for FireWise, Living with Fire, Ready, Set, Go. All of those programs have fantastic information, and as you know, Steve is testament to that. Taking care of your land can really make a difference when a fire approaches, and I do need to mention, when we're talking about personal responsibility, with landowners going in and doing thinning, if there are power lines in the area, we don't want folks necessarily getting too close to those. And so that's when bringing the professionals in, and there are cost-sharing programs out there, as Steve mentioned, where some of the thinning on your land can be assisted with funding. We want folks to be very careful. This is not something about, hey, go buy a chainsaw and start cutting down trees. There is a method to this and a right way to do it. And so especially when there are power lines involved, you want to be very, very cautious.
All right. And I believe we're about to take a short break, and I think we'll be losing both Steve Detmer and Keith Nix. And if we do, thank you so much for fitting yourselves in this crowded program and for imparting some really valuable information to people. We will take that break. But, John, when we return, someone has emailed you a question exactly the direction we wanted to go in, talking about the health of our forests and drought situation. So let's go ahead and take a break. You're listening to the KUNM Call-In Show.
Dig into reading and be part of the Albuquerque Bernalillo County Library Summer Reading Program. From June 1st to July 27th, children, teens, and adults can register, read, earn rewards, and attend special events, including storytellers, magicians, musicians, art workshops, and more. Stop by a local library to sign up. For more information on summer reading and a full schedule of events, visit abclibrary.org or call 311. A message from the tax-exempt Friends for the Public Library.
Welcome back to the KUNM Call-In Show as we discuss New Mexico's early wildfire season. I'm joined in the studio still by Albuquerque Journal reporter John Fleck and New Mexico State Forestry Service Manager Dan Ware is still on our phone. If you'd like to participate in our discussion, you can email comments to callinshow@kunm.org. You may post comments on the Call-In Show webpage at kunm.org. You may do the old-fashioned way, 277-5866. That's 277-KUNM. Or our toll-free number, 1-877-899-5866. Tell us if you are under threat of evacuation, if you live in a forested or semi-forested area, what precautions have you taken? How do you think the state of New Mexico might minimize the fire danger posed by downed power lines? John, we have someone who emailed in. Colin emailed. He asked, John, is it not true that forests in the western Cordillera biostructure cannot be made safe from fire, but safe for fire, that in areas treated, it is more a matter of positive effect as opposed to, quote, less damage, unquote?
Colin nailed it. Tree ring histories that have been done in the southwestern United States show that before, you know, large-scale European immigrant involvement in the 1800s, these forests in the southwest burn typically every 5 to 10 years. It was ground fire. It burned through the grasses. It was a healthy and normal part of the ecosystem. Natural fire starts with lightning, sometimes widespread, sometimes small. And so it cleared out the undergrowth, and you had these, especially in the Ponderosa Forest, these large open stands of trees, park-like settings, and fire was an important and healthy part of that. Starting with grazing, and the Jemez is just a case study of this, starting with grazing, intensive grazing, when grazing got really intensive in the 1800s, that clears out the grass that carries fire. That's step one. Then, you know, in the early part of the 20th century, we began putting out fires, and the result is that we've created this enormous buildup of fuel. And these things, you know, this 2002 story that you quoted from earlier that I was reading recently, you know, Craig Allen, the biologist in the Jemez, that says these forests are going to reset themselves if we don't come in and do the work that needs to be done to clear them out. But one of the things we need to do is we need to accustom ourselves to smoke and to the presence of fires naturally in this ecosystem. And this, I think, goes to a really important question. We've been talking a lot about a narrow question of electric power lines here. And, you know, we've had three, you know, significant fires caused by downed electric power lines. But that's just a symptom of a broader component of this problem, which is, and it's a journalist named Michael Kotis up in Colorado who's written extensively about this, and we have dramatically increased what the fire community folks call the wildland-urban interface. It's a bit of a misnomer. So essentially, we're just building houses in the woods. Mm. And so that creates two things. One, that puts humans and structures at risk when a fire happens, and it makes it harder to allow natural fire to happen. And two, it puts humans out in an environment where through a variety of ways, you know, fireworks, cars sparking, hot exhaust pipes, downed electric lines, we can cause fire starts. And so there's a lot more opportunities, and power lines we're focused on right now because we happen to have a few power line fires, but there are lots of ways humans can cause fires. Until we can get in and make the forests healthy enough that a fire start is not a giant problem, even if we fix the power line problem, that will reduce that component of fire starts. But we're going to continue to have these problems until we can get in and make the forests healthy enough for natural fire to happen.
Well, let's back up a second here, and let's just give listeners a sense of just how dry it is in some of our forests. I don't know if you have those figures available about how dry are the Jemez Mountains.
So the Jemez, Craig Allen up at the Bandelier National Monument sent me some numbers. I don't have my glasses on here. Since October 1, which is the start of the water year, 1.92 inches of precip at the Jemez Fire Tower as of the end of May. I don't think they got any since then. That's a quarter of normal. That's the third year in a row. The previous two full years were around half of normal, so three consecutive very dry years. We have warm temperatures. I mean, climate change is a piece of this. Natural variability is a piece of this, but climate change is clearly layering on top of all the other problems. The natural variability of drought is adding some temperature component, which makes, given the amount of precipitation falls, it stresses the trees, it causes more evaporation, causes more water loss in the trees. So it makes the forest that much more vulnerable when you combine it with the natural variability of this drought we're in and the bad forest health. Those things combined, it's sort of like a perfect storm right now.
Well, in a perfect storm that everyone, in quotation marks, is aware has been coming.
Yeah.
So, but where do we place this perfect storm in the sea of perfect storms that are on our horizon?
Well, so, I mean, there's a couple of different ways to think about that. Independent of climate change, we know that using tree rings over thousands of years, droughts like we're seeing now have happened. They haven't been quite as warm. This is on the warmer side. But in terms of the combination of drought of dry conditions and warm conditions, the drought we're in right now, the last 10-12 years, it's sort of in the top five in the last 1,000 years. So it's an outlier, but it's not the worst. If you look at, and this is some really interesting research by a scientist named Park Williams up at Los Alamos, if you look at the combination of climate change that we anticipate over the next century and the natural variability that causes droughts to come and go, then the normal drought of the mid-century is going to be on a scale of the worst droughts we've ever seen in terms of stress on these forests and tree death because of beetles, which are opportunistically attacking trees in drought, and also fire. So, I mean, that gives you some kind of a scale of what we're in now and what we're headed toward.
Okay. Let's go ahead and bring in a couple of callers. Brian has been waiting patiently on the phone. He's from Santa Fe. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Kathleen. This is Brian with Water Earth Guardians, and I want to compliment your guests today, especially Dan Ware. His discussion of wildland-urban interface and the responsibility of private homeowners is critical. But I want to bring up two points that I don't know that you've discussed yet, and maybe your experts can answer these questions. But there's two entities that probably play a major role in regulating private land maintenance, and that would be the counties, who obviously have ordinances that they can impose to keep certain tree clearances away from power lines. So the counties seem to have a role that hasn't been discussed. And another big one are insurance companies. What role do insurance companies play in making sure private landowners keep their homes fire safe, but also keep their power lines clear? And do insurance companies bear some fiscal responsibility when a fire starts on private land and spreads to public land? Because this is going to be an expensive time for our federal government putting these fires out. So thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for calling, Brian. Let's see if Dan wants to respond to that.
Well, we work with all of our what we call interagency partners. That's the local, state, federal. And he's right. The insurance companies are playing a bigger role, and the insurance industry has become much more active in the fire arena. We're seeing more and more insurance companies participating in fire prevention and preparedness programs. I went to a class last year on home assessment, in other words, working with homeowners to assess their buildings for their how fire safe they are. And half of the class was full of insurance company representatives. They are taking a bigger role, and we're getting calls every year from folks who say, I just heard from my insurance company, and they're not going to quote me on my insurance because we live in an area in the wildland urban interface that is prone to fire. So what can I do? And that's where we bring in these fire prevention programs and working with the counties and getting the counties involved to spread the word about programs like Ready, Set, Go and FireWise to deal with that. You know, state forestry doesn't really handle or get involved with zoning issues per se, but we can help landowners do some of this mitigation that will make their communities more able to handle fire. And it's great if we work with one landowner, but it's even better if we can get a whole neighborhood and then a whole community involved.
Let's bring in David. It says here on my screen, he's a mile from Thompson Ridge. David, good morning. Thank you for holding, and thank you for joining us.
Yes, good morning, and thank you. And first of all, I'd like to say that I patiently listened on hold for almost a half hour. I would like to be heard out, and then I would like to remain on the line for the comments that are made, and so that I have a chance to correct anybody if they try to change my words. First of all, I will compliment the various government agencies for their efforts and their skills at doing the work that they do perform. However, I deeply believe that policy from the top is flawed. It is nice to hear Dan basically starting to say what I've been saying publicly for several years, and that goes back to the very basis of this, is that the problem with the potential for forest fires is directly caused by the various government agencies, the Forest Service, by suppressing the fires, like Dan admitted to and the Forest Service has previously admitted to for 80 or 100 years. They did the equivalent of carry a bucket of gasoline out and place it at the base of every tree, because if they had not suppressed the fires, then these problems would not occur. And if you want to use legal terms, the Forest Service literally has created an attractive nuisance in the forest. And let me comment that maybe changes to another comment just made by a caller, and that's that there is no private liability for a fire. If a homeowner uses a chainsaw or whatever and starts a fire that turns into forest fire, the homeowner is not liable whatsoever, because the Forest Service created the attractive nuisance through negligence. And so if you want to talk about a liability issue, and then let me go on to...
Well, David, let me go ahead and stop you there, because we're running out of time here, and I know people want to comment. And I'm just, Dan and John, I want to get your comments. I also just want to throw in an email from Philip earlier. He asked, if oil companies are responsible for environmental damage caused by leaks or spills, why are electric utilities not responsible for damage caused by fires that they're caused by their leaking and sparking power lines? And David is asking, why is the Forest Service not responsible? John, how do you want to respond?
Well, I mean, sure, but we have had a changing political environment. The Forest Service is an entity of our government, and we for a long time wanted them and asked them to put out fires. So to blame the Forest Service is, I think, to not recognize the complicated nature of our political system. I mean, we have done a whole slew of things in the last century because we didn't understand the effect that we, as this giant growing industrialized population, were having on the environment. We built dams, you know, that have screwed up ecosystems and changed our water supply. We put out forest fires thinking that was the right thing to do. You know, sure, hindsight is 20/20. The question of liability doesn't seem a helpful thing. I mean, I think the Forest Service the forestry community for the last 10, 15, 20 years has recognized this problem, is working to try to fix it. But blame doesn't seem helpful.
Dan, did you want to comment briefly on anything David had to say?
Well, and my perspective is from state forestry, not the Federal Forest Service. We work with the private landowners, and as more and more people move out into the forested areas, we have more and more people who they want to live among, you know, the trees. I mean, who wouldn't? It's, you know, you want the privacy, you want the natural resource surrounding. It's a question also of learning how to live in that kind of an environment so that it's healthy for everybody. And so a lot of what we do at State Forestry is teach folks that you're not, if you leave all your trees the way they are and just let them grow and grow and grow over time, you're going to have an unhealthy forest. And so the personal responsibility is not just on agencies, but also on the folks who choose to live in these environments. If I say to you, we have far too many trees in the forest, a lot of people are going to say, what? And so it's, again, it's a question of education, education for landowners and education for us. We learn new things about our environment every year.
Well, and you know, this is not limited to what we're learning about forests and behavior. Our oceans are changing as well. It's akin to people, you know, living on the coastline and being wiped out and then moving back. So, I mean, there are things we probably can learn from each other in different parts of the country, I would imagine.
Absolutely.
Yes, and
Absolutely.
And Dan, just to make clear, you are not with the U.S. Forest Service. This is the State Forestry Service. And again, if you want to give out your quick URL, we'll post it. But if you want to give out your website address, that'd be great.
Sure. It's nmforestry.com.
Okay. Thank you for that. And so, John, this is the early part of the wildfire season. What are experts saying?
Experts have been saying, you know, as we went into the season, my colleague Pat Lohman did a great story setting up the season. Everybody knew this could be really we are primed for a very, very bad fire season. And then two variables that are simply unpredictable have to happen. What kind of fire starts are we going to get? We're entering the dry lightning season, so you can get a lot of natural fire starts. We have all these humans living in the woods, so that's a fire start. And then what is the weather like when that fire starts? So if you look at Las Conchas 2 years ago, we had a tree hit a power line and spark a fire during, you know, the worst possible hours of the worst possible day of the entire fire season. So there's a bunch of forests in the state that are primed for giant fires, and they may or may not happen. We almost got out of this 2 years ago. Las Conchas was right at the end of the fire season. We're early in the fire season. There's a bunch more chances. These two fires used to be 10,000 acre class fires were a big deal. These two fires are, you know, look like they might not be giant. There was some fears with Tres Lagunas because there's a big unburned area around there that could have gotten it, and the weather cooperated and the fire teams did a good job. You don't know. We could have big fires or we could not. You don't know.
Well, you know, and there are so many things we're not equipped to talk about today, like the health effects on people from the smoke. And Dan, I noted that you had a link to the Department of Health website on your website as well. Are you, when you're out and about and you're hearing, oh, early, I'm going to be in my car a lot, I'm going to be doing updates a lot. But is there anything that that people are asking you or anything coming forward with regard to health concerns of people?
Well, I think any time we have a fire, large or small, people are very concerned with the smoke. And obviously, the Department of Health is very, very in tune with what's going on with these big fires. And also, we're getting smoke from other states. Arizona has had some fires, and that filters smoke in. There are fires in Mexico that come up our way. The Department of Health's website, nmtracking.org, has a lot of great information for folks who suffer from respiratory illness or who are just concerned about the smoke as well. And so I would urge folks to go to that, nmtracking.org, for some great information on your health as it relates to wildfire smoke.
And Dan, if someone's out there listening and they've heard John say we're primed for fires and they know it's going to happen and they're living in a forested area, what is something they can do? This is a brief comment. Where can they go?
Go to nmforestry.com and click on the fire program link, and you'll just two clicks, and you'll have great information on what the simple things you can do to prepare your home for a wildfire.
Okay, thank you so much for that information. We want to go ahead and thank our guests, Albuquerque Journal reporter John Fleck, Dan Ware with the New Mexico State Forestry, and PNM employees Steve Detmer and Keith Nix, who joined us for a portion of our show, for making themselves available to our listeners. Thanks also to our callers for helping to develop our discussion today. Thanks to our engineer, Roman Garcia, our assistant engineer, Marshall Broyles, our assistant producer, Andy Lyman. Michael Hess has handled our phones today. Elaine Baumgartel is our executive producer. I'm Kathleen Sabo. This has been the KUNM Call-In Show on your public radio station, KUNM Albuquerque.